Well, it's my privilege to be here, to be blown across the Tay Bridge, and to share with you on what is a very important subject, and one that's very important for the gospel. And here's why. Because many, many people assume that science and faith are opposed. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. I once knocked on a man's door, and he came to the door, and I said, "Hi, I'm from the local church," and he immediately said, "I'll get the wife," which is apparently standard of Scottish males, that they think real men aren't interested in Christianity. But I said, no, you beard, me man, we talk. And he looked at me and he said, it's obviously Dundee, and he said, "I don't believe in God, I believe in science." I said, "Oh, you're a scientist?" "No." "You study science?" "No." "You studied science at university?" "No." "At school?" "No." "Do you ever read any science?" "No, I just believe in it." Now, that's an extreme example, but I'll guarantee you, you could walk into pubs here, and you see people say, "Oh, science has just kind of disproved God." And for those of you who have an understanding of these things, you realize that that's a ludicrous concept, but it's one that's fueled by people like Richard Dawkins, and it's part, very, very much part of our culture. I will go to secondary schools. It's great to see some of the younger people here. And I went to a secondary school, Monifieth High, and the third year class, and every single person in that class said, "I don't believe in God." "Why?" "Because science is disproved." And in actual fact, their parents didn't believe, and there was a whole bunch of other reasons in there as well. But it is a very, very strong, deeply ingrained myth, sometimes not helped by some Christians who will say, "Well, I've got faith, you've got science," which is just as ludicrous an idea. So we're going to look at this. I just started reading this book. I haven't seen the television series yet, Brian Cox, Human Universe. It's for me absolutely fascinating, and I'll refer to it at the end. But Mr. Cox, just very simply, Professor Cox, is exactly the same. His view is that as you grow in knowledge about science, you have less need for God. Bottom line is, people who believe in God are people who are largely ignorant. They don't know enough. And the more you know, the less likely you are to believe in God. So it helps, I think. Normally in church, we would do a kind of exegetical sermon from the Word of God, and I'm going to constantly be referring to the Word of God, but it's not that kind of talk this evening. So I think it helps us to ask, first of all, what is actually science? When we say science, sometimes people have a conversation and we talk past each other because we don't know what each other is saying. So many of the people who say, "You've got faith, I've got science," they have no concept of what faith is, what Christian faith is. But let's ask what science is. Now, we've always wanted to examine the world around us. We are very, very curious people. And what we're referring to as science largely emerges in the 17th century. Now, I realize some of you are going to be brilliant people and you'll know all the details of this. And this is a bit like teaching your grandmother to suck eggs, though I don't know what that actually means. But because my granny never sucked eggs, but this is a general overview, so please realize that. And when it comes to the questions, please feel free to, if you want, go into more detail. But about the 17th century, what we know as the scientific method began to emerge. The Renaissance and the Protestant Reformation, the industrialization of society, increased urbanization, improved technology, resulted in this whole scientific revolution, or even perhaps stemmed from it. New scientific instruments, such as the telescope. And then the first scientific instrument that could measure something that human beings can't measure. That was the barometer, measured air pressure. The key person, I think, in this at this time is a man called Francis Bacon, who argued that all the knowledge that we have should be based on data. And that's a position that, and again, for those of you philosophy students, you're going, yeah, we know this, but lots of other people don't. It's called empiricism. Our senses observe and experiment with the world. You observe phenomena. There's the wind blowing. How was the wind blowing? Why is it blowing? What's occurring? You take a stab at why. You create a hypothesis. You test it. You falsify it. You prove whether it works or not. And you then move on. The whole idea of empiricism is that you can experiment, that you can test. And if you cannot test and verify with the senses, then you could argue that it doesn't exist. Bacon also argued, of course, that knowledge was power. To know is to control. Facts come first, and then your theories are derived from the facts. Interestingly enough, Brian Cox says the whole key to everything is education. But it's very interesting. What he wants is education only in one particular philosophy. Now, science then, we developed what's called the mathematization of nature. I have a friend that some of you will know, John Lennox, who's a professor of the philosophy of science and mathematics at the University of Oxford. And John is he's a great character, and I wish he was here giving this talk instead. But he, one time I was joking with him, and I said, there's nothing proves God apart from mathematics. And he said, yes, absolutely correct. Mathematics is the source of everything. Well, I was useless at maths at school, and I didn't even think about doing it at university. But apparently mathematics, according to him, is the foundation of everything. But the mathematization of nature is very interesting because it's the whole idea that natural events and phenomena can be accurately described using mathematical equations. You can, for example, do the projection of the Earth around the Sun and so on. And we know that actually the universe does consist of maths. Now, part of that then came the mechanization of nature. There's always a mechanism. Isaac Newton, probably, arguably the greatest scientist who's ever existed, he recognized this. He recognized there was a mechanism, that in nature it wasn't just random, and he used maths considerably. As a result, out of that developed the whole idea of science as a methodology. At its most basic level, you make careful, repeated observations in a lab, or you could do field-based science taking many years. You can do historical science, setting up models in the present to try and explain what's happened in the past, as, for example, with geology and cosmology. But the bottom idea is this. The main idea is science is a method of finding out things, testing ideas against real data. And from a Christian perspective, I'm looking at this and saying, uh-huh, that's great. Why would we be opposed to that? In fact, it's very interesting when you go back to these early scientists, when you go back to Newton, when you go back to the founding of the Royal Society, virtually all of its members were Puritans. And if you don't know anything about the Puritans, they're good guys. Some people say they're not, but they're really good guys. I think they're great guys. But they were very committed biblical Christians. And because they believed that there was a God, because they believed the universe was ordered, because they believed in what they called the two books that God has given, one being the Bible, but the other being nature or creation, they thought it was their responsibility to study. And in fact, up until the mid-19th century, what you would find in places like St. Andrews and elsewhere, that people who were ministers and clergymen, sometimes they had more time than ministers seem to have today, and they were very good at developing interest in the sciences. For those of you historians, it's very interesting how the conflict between science and faith was developed by Thomas Huxley, because he wanted to get the clergy out of science, so he created this completely artificial divide. And it's one that's been bought into and perpetuated by, sadly, many Christians as well. And as I say, it's something that our atheist friends try and push all the time. But let me say something about the scientific method. Because science is not everything. There's a professor in Oxford, Peter Aitkins, who argues that science will be able to explain everything. Well, science cannot explain everything. There are limits, for example, in empiricism. How many times do you need to do an experiment before you decide it is true? So, for example, there was a saying, as white as a swan, because in Europe, up until the 18th century, all the swans that anyone had ever seen had been white. So that made sense. And then we went to Australia and we discovered some black swans. So you did an experiment, if you like. You observed every swan ever seen by everyone that you knew and everyone that was written down had been white. And then all of a sudden you discover one that's black. There are limits in how much we can work things out and find things out. Science also never starts with a simple observation. We are not neutral. Sometimes we see or hear what we expect to see or hear. We have a lot of medics in our church in Dundee. I believe that there are people who study medicine here and then go to Manchester. I don't know why. You should just nip over the bridge and come to a real hospital. Nonetheless, there are people who do that. And medics, I mean, I love medics and I love doctors. But it can be quite morbid when you're talking with medics. They've got a big new dissection building across the University of Dundee. And when you've got students talking about cutting up bodies, and you know, you have to encourage them to... I'm a chaplain at the university, and we do a kind of service every year for all the bodies that have been cut up. And we remind the students constantly to teach, to treat the bodies with respect. But I know this about dissection. I know nothing about medicine. But I know this, that dissection can be really confusing unless you know what you're expected to be looking for. There are some observations that require a great deal of education before you can make them. So, for example, you go into hospital, and I hope this doesn't happen to you, and there's a surgeon there, and he's going to cut you up. I want a surgeon. I don't want a first-year medic going, here's a scalpel. Oh! Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that bit there. You know, I really don't want that. You want them to have some knowledge before they do it. And that is true also of a great deal of science. And the interesting thing is, our observation doesn't come before the theory. People are taught things. A wonderful woman called Kirstine Burkitt writes on this, and she gives an example of this. She says, you'll never get a scientific paper which says this: I put the thin stick with the numbers on it in a liquid which had bubbles in it, and the red stuff in the stick reached up to the 97, which is one way of saying the water's temperature was 97 degrees centigrade. In order to make that latter statement, you've got to know what centigrade is, you've got to know what temperature is. In other words, you do have to be educated in order to be able to do the science. So good science is something that we are taught, that we observe, but also a good scientist will hold their theories in doubt. It's why Richard Dawkins, for example, will never say, I am 100% certain there is no God. Because as a good scientist, he's not supposed to be 100% certain about anything. In fact, I once heard him interviewed in which he said, in 200 years' time, it may be proven that the theory of evolution is wrong. He's based his whole life on that theory, but he admitted that that was possible. Because a good scientist is always going to say, I've got a question. I've got to ask and find out. Science, if you like, may explain the world as we see it and know it, but we can never be absolutely sure. And this is a very important thing. Science lacks certainty in discovering knowledge. And in our culture, most people think it's the other way around. Part of that is that scientific theories have often changed. I think that's an advantage in science. I think it's great that a genuine scientist is open to change. But I want to make a suggestion here, and again, this is open for question. Even Richard Dawkins will admit to this. At least he'll admit to it in a historical sense, that it's very difficult for science to take place without a theistic worldview. Now, what do we mean by that? The majority of human beings, for the majority of human life, have believed that the world was chaos, that there were many gods, that there was a god of the wind and a god of the sun and a god of particular areas, that there were gods and demons. And if you read, for example, the Greeks, you read the Romans, you read the pagans, that whole idea is implicit, if not explicit, in that. However, along comes monotheism, and in particular Judaism, then Christianity, eventually Islam as well, and a monotheistic view of the world or of the universe is this, that there is one God who creates everything. Because he creates everything, the world is not chaos, it's ordered. You cannot study disorder. The whole foundational principle of science is that there is order in the universe that you can look at. Now, there are other things I'd want to say about science. There are certain things in science that are much more certain. For example, general laws such as thermodynamics, organisms made of cells, chemical substances made of atoms. There are things that where there is more doubt. For example, black holes that has strong supporting evidence but is open to revision. And then there is highly speculative and unconfirmed theories. For example, the multiverse theory, Hawking's unbounded universe theory, something which Brian Cox also picks up on. Science is a community of people as well, and sometimes you will find people saying things or believing things just because they're impressed by the other people around them, and also because of the paradigms within which they think. But I guess one of the key things I would want to stress to you is that science as a means of testing or looking at facts or evidence is one thing, but scientism as a philosophy is another. Now, what do we mean by that? And this is where people get very confused. Scientism is basically materialistic naturalism. All that is, it's a belief that only natural, as opposed to supernatural or spiritual laws and forces, work in the world. That everything can be explained in scientific terms. I have one friend who I asked her about this. She was a postdoc chemist, brilliant, brilliant person, now in the United States. And I said to her, do you believe that everything is chemical, ultimately chemical? And she said, yes, I do. And then I asked her, do you live like that? And she says, no, I don't. I couldn't. Is everything chemical? I mean, you think about who you are. According to Bertrand Russell, philosopher, atheist philosopher, you are a blob of carbon going from one meaningless existence to another. Is that what you are? You're just a blob of carbon. So when you die, I go, well, there's another blob of carbon gone. Ultimately, you're of no more significance than a cockroach or a gnat. What makes it you any different? Are you just atoms? You just cells? Well, naturalism would say that. Now, the trouble with naturalism, of course, it's very easily refuted at one level, because naturalism says the only things that are true are things that you can demonstrate to be true naturalistically, empirically. The only statements that you can make that would be true would be that. The only trouble is, that's a philosophy, again, for those of you who are into philosophy, called logical positivism. The trouble with it is this: that statement itself cannot be proved to be true, and therefore it's a self-defeating statement. I think I want to go back to the Christian view of science, and a view that is held by many, many people. Most people assume, well, most scientists are not Christians. That's true. But a survey was done in the year 1901. 42% of scientists in the West identified themselves as theists. That same survey was done in 2001. After a century of atheist propaganda, what do you think the result was? It was 41%. You know, there are many, many people who are scientists who believe in God. I can think of lecturers in science at St. Andrews University, lecturers at the University of Dundee. I think of the many doctors and scientists in my own congregation. We have a scientists in congregation in churches group, which has just started up. In fact, we'll have their first meeting tomorrow. These are people who all believe in God, but they're also all scientists. I think Francis Bacon and others thought that they were the interpreters and discoverers of nature of the book that God had made. No one disputes that science examines natural causes. However, that's not the same as saying that natural causes are all that exist. Science also is not about purpose. Again, I owe John Lennox this. I love this illustration. You may not love it, but I loved it, and I understood it, so maybe that's why I loved it. Maybe it's too simple for you. But he talks about a kettle. There's a kettle boiling. Can you explain why the kettle is boiling? Yes, you can. You can explain about thermodynamics, you can explain about electricity, you can explain about the temperature need, you can explain it in scientific terms. Can you explain why the kettle is boiling? That you put it on to make a cup of tea for your granny who's coming to visit. And you do this because you love your granny and so on. That's not really open to a scientific demonstration. Lennox again uses exactly the same thing when he says, can you explain how a Ford car works? If you understand mechanics, if you understand the principles of the internal combustion engine and so on. Yes, you can. But just because you can explain it, does that mean that Henry Ford didn't exist? Because you can explain how it works. When we ask the why questions, that is very, very different. Here's another thing that's vital. Science is amoral. Not immoral, but amoral. Science doesn't teach us any form of morality. You split the atom, science doesn't tell you whether you should use it to bomb someone or whether you should use it to generate energy to create electricity to light houses. Moral values are not part of science. One of the best scientists in the world was a man called Josef Mengele. Now, Mengele used to take Jewish twins, and he would experiment on them. His scientific results, in some ways, were brilliant. But was he right to do that? Was it moral for him to do that? What did science say? Science said nothing, because science isn't moral. Now, please understand, that's not saying that all scientists are Nazis, and it's not saying that scientists are immoral. It's just saying that science itself doesn't give us moral values. That's why someone like Francis Collins, who is an atheist, when he began his leadership of the Human Genome Project, which finally resulted in probably the greatest scientific discovery of the past century, that's why when he started as an atheist, he ended up as a Christian, because he could not explain. It was C.S. Lewis's moral argument. He couldn't answer it. And he realized that without God, morality ultimately did not have meaning. He wasn't saying it couldn't exist, but it didn't have meaning. Truth, morality, beauty. How do we live with suffering? Why is there suffering at all? Science cannot even begin to answer those questions. Now, I want to back off a little bit from that and say, well, what's Christianity got to do with this? That we've looked a lot at what science is. Let's think a little bit about faith. Here's a very interesting, I'm trying to get someone to do the research for me on this, but this is what I believe has happened. The word faith has changed its meaning in most dictionaries within the past 20 years. You look at most dictionaries from 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago, at least in the English language, and the word faith is never used in the way that it's predominantly used in dictionaries nowadays. Because nowadays, it's faith is believing something that is contrary to or in spite of the evidence. So it's contrasted with reason. You've got reason and you've got faith. That's not the biblical use of the word faith. And I would want to argue that faith is, the biblical way that we use faith is a very different understanding that many people will have. Dundee are going to win the European Cup, never mind the Scottish Premier League. That's probably faith, considerable faith. Maybe you require less faith to believe that England are going to win the next Ashes series, maybe. I only said that for Paul's interest. But I don't know. But John 20, verse 31 tells us these things were written that you may believe. See, telling people to have faith, and incidentally, for those of you who are Christians, it's absolutely crazy to go to someone and say, you've got to have faith in Jesus Christ, if they don't know who Jesus Christ is. What does have faith mean? Sometimes you get someone like Prince Charles who'll say, I want to be the king of faiths, if you like, not the defender of faith, or not the faith, which means, as the Queen is at the moment, the Christian faith. And that just sounds so good, but then no, it's not good at all. Yeah, you have faith, you're a person of faith. Well, what if someone said, I have faith, but my faith is that Elvis is alive and that he lives on the moon and he's surrounded by giant rats who one day he's going to ride back to Earth and save us from all the cancers and everything in the world. Would you look at someone who said, I've got that faith, and say, oh, isn't that sweet? You've got faith. I'm glad you've got something to help you through. I would just go, no, you're nuts. Technically, that's the term. You're crazy. What on earth do you believe that for? And it's daft to use faith in the sense of saying, well, I've just got faith. I've got faith this is going to happen. Now, the way that the Christian uses faith is this, that it's not so much the fact that you have faith, it's what or who you have faith in. My strong belief as a Christian is that I have faith and trust in Jesus Christ. I think I have plenty reason for believing that. I think I have plenty evidence. But I can never prove it in the same way as none of you here can basically prove anything. I like doing this when I go to school, so for the younger people here as well, here's something for you just to help you with your nightmares. How can you prove that you didn't come into existence yesterday? Now you think, that's a question for you. You can ask me that back through there if you want. How can you prove that? How can you prove that there are other conscious minds other than your own? Or my favorite out of the Matrix, it's just simply this. How can any of you prove to yourselves, never mind to me, that right now you are not wired up to a machine, you're lying in a vat of chemicals, and you're wired up to a computer that's telling you that you're listening to a man telling you that you're wired up to a computer? How can you prove that that's not true? Now, I may be strange, but those kinds of questions just get me going round and round and round and round at night. And sometimes you just think, wait. And see, when someone comes to you, you prove God. Well, what do they mean by prove? Most things we believe are a combination of evidence, which is different from proof. Evidence and reason and all the things that go on. And I just want to outline to you the basic Christian position of the universe. We believe that God created everything. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that he did organize the universe to be intelligible, that we can actually read it. We believe that God upholds everything. In him we live and move and have our being. He sustains all things by his powerful word. That's what the passage you read in Colossians says to us. We believe that God works through normal means and laws. The sparrow falls to the ground. It's not that God is going, right, zap, that's another sparrow. It's not like God is playing some kind of giant sim game, killing people and individuals, but there are laws and principles which he has created, which he then lets continue, but it's not as though he cannot himself intervene. We believe that God created human beings as the apex of his creation to live in harmony with nature and in relationship with him. Human beings are different from the rest of the creation, and not just because we have the capacity to think. And again, I don't have time to go into that. And we believe what the Bible teaches, that Adam and Eve decided to go on their own, that they decided to live without God, and that disruption and disharmony was brought into the world, that now the world is confusing, that now there are enormous effects of sin, that we live in a broken universe, in broken societies. Many of us are broken people, and we will all eventually end up with broken bodies. Some of us have those already. And the Bible's story is the story of how God comes to redeem and to rescue and to save that creation. How he sends his son, Jesus Christ, to restore the relationship. Now, the point about all of that is that does not destroy our understanding or is not in opposition to science. That enhances. Someone will say, well, don't be ridiculous. Richard Dawkins, for example, would say, you believe that God raised people from the dead. Now, or that particularly Jesus rose from the dead. That just doesn't happen. My answer to that is very straightforward. Mr. Dawkins, you say in your book, The God Delusion, that there are multiverses and that I exist in one of those universes, in that multiverse, where I'm already dead. And that I also exist in one of those universes with a green mustache. And I'm thinking, okay, so you think it's okay as a scientist to believe that people here believe in another, or exist in another universe and they've got green mustaches, but it's ridiculous to believe that an almighty God could raise his son from the dead. I don't see why it's ridiculous at all. It's only ridiculous if your first presupposition is that there is no God. It's not ridiculous if you were to allow even for the possibility that there could be such a God. It's a false conflict, in other words. Mr. Cox, let me just give you a couple of examples. Now, I've not read the whole book, but I was stunned by it at the beginning. I read the beginning, and then I jumped to the end, and I will read the bits in between. But I was stunned. I've already spoiled this beautiful book by highlighting things, and my wife absolutely hates this. But if you read this book from now on, you will see yellow and orange highlighters, at least if you borrow my version. This is what Brian Cox says. He says that he's written this book as a love letter to humanity. He says, in building on these ideas, my view is that we humans represent an isolated island of meaning in a meaningless universe. Now, stop and think about that for a moment. We're an island of meaning in a meaningless universe. And I should immediately clarify what I mean by meaningless. I see no reason for the existence of the universe in a teleological sense. There is surely no final cause or purpose. And what he goes on to say, he goes on to talk about how human beings are at the center of the universe. Now, this book is actually really important for a very important reason in the atheist world. It is because someone like Carl Sagan, and since him, virtually all scientists who are atheists, have argued the universe is so massive, human beings are so small. Human beings are not significant. They've gone the Bertrand Russell route. You're just a blob of carbon. What Brian Cox is doing, he's reversing it. He's actually saying that this is the human universe, that this universe exists for humans, that we are the center of it, we are the apex of it. We are not the pale blue dot with just a few of us going around like little insects. And ironically, the Bible comes back to that all the time. That's what the Bible's saying. You've got two choices here. Your choice is you can say, well, human beings are the center of the universe, we're the apex of creation, we're the top of the tree when it comes to evolution. Or we can say that actually the universe exists for the glory of God. Psalm 19 says this, the heavens declare the glory of God. I do not go out, look up at the stars. I grew up in the north of Scotland in the Highlands, and I used to walk along a thing called the Morrick Moor between my house and Tain Academy, and I'd walk back late at night. And you look up at the stars, I could never look at the stars and go, wow, aren't humans great? I looked up and I went, wow, aren't humans small? And isn't it incredible? I tried really, really hard to be an atheist, but it just didn't make any sense. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies teach, proclaim his handiwork. And actually, many scientists have believed that. The early scientists, Newton's and others, absolutely saw that and grasped it and understood it. The reason that Richard Dawkins and others want to use science and interpret it in another way is not because they're scientists, it's because they're atheists. It's because they don't want to believe in God. Sir Fred Hoyle, when he discovered one particular aspect of the Big Bang, in particular the fine-tuning of the universe, said this, nothing shook his atheism more than that. It was as though a hurricane had gone through a scrapyard, and when the hurricane had finished, there stood a Boeing 747 ready to fly. And he says that really shook his atheism. We were at a house last night, a friend of mine who's a consultant eye surgeon, and he said that he's a brilliant mind, and he said that Darwin said the same thing, that the complexity of the human eye is such that it takes a phenomenal amount of faith to believe that it just happened to evolve. And I think, personally, that is an incredibly powerful argument. I find it extraordinary that people like Brian Cox and others, because they want to do away with the implications of a finely tuned universe and the fact that the universe had a beginning, that they are now reverting to, actually, there's an eternal universe, or at least there was a universe before the universe and there are multiverses and so on. Why are they doing that? Because it's scientific? No. They're doing it because they want to avoid God. And I want to encourage those of you who are Christians to be involved in science and to marvel at it. But I want you to do so with a degree of humility, recognizing that human beings don't know everything. And I want to encourage those of you who are not Christians. Science doesn't prove against God, it doesn't prove for God. But it was in this town that I heard David Watson, I think it was, from the University of Durham, professor of physics at the University of Durham, packed lecture theater, and he was asked a question at the end where one of the students said, are you saying that you think that cosmology proves God? And he said, no, I am not saying that, but I'm saying that it points to God. And I think that science points to God. I think it declares the glory of God. I do think you need scripture to interpret and to tell us particularly about Jesus and to tell us what's gone wrong in the world, but I would put them all together. The last thing I'll say is just simply this. In that passage in Colossians, it says we are not to be taken captive by the philosophies of this world. That we are, how's the phrase there, that we are to take our life, which is hidden with Christ in God. And I think that there's a wonderful thing in Brian Cox's book where he says, I am going to stick with humanity because as far as we know, human beings, Earth is the only place where love is found in the universe. Now, how's that for hubris? How can he possibly demonstrate and prove it? The Bible comes with a very interesting thing. The Bible says that God is love and that any love that we have is a reflection of that. Ultimately, I think words like love and beauty are utterly meaningless in a totally atheistic world. Again, I'm going back to my friend Richard Dawkins in The Blind Watchmaker. He talks about the universe has exactly the properties that you would expect if there was no God, no truth, no good, no beauty. It's just blind, pitiless indifference is a phrase that he uses. That's not the universe I live in. I don't think that the love and the beauty and the truth and the music and everything that we have, I don't think that you are all freaks and accidents and just bunches of chemicals and that everything that you really value is meaningless. I think the universe has meaning. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. And yes, it is under the sun. But if you go beyond the merely physical, you can see that everything has meaning. And that would be, that for me, that would be the argument I make. I am driven to two choices. Sometimes I have many doubts and many fears about many, many things. I cannot find myself to have enough faith to believe that it's all an accident, that ultimately you and I are meaningless, it's all going to disappear into nothing. That to me is incomprehensible. And when I look at what God has done in Jesus Christ, I think, just wow. Just, it's incredible. I don't understand, if you're an atheist, how you can live in reality. I think you just live in a fantasy world. I think it's believers in Jesus Christ who can actually face up to reality. And I leave you with that simple challenge. Paul, thank you.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. We've got a few good questions here, which will keep us going for a couple of minutes before we head through for coffee. David, the first two, I'll take them together. It may not surprise you to know that they're about the book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible. And the first is this. My friend tells me that he won't believe in God because the proof of dinosaurs existing and evolution disproves Genesis. He says you can't pick and choose which parts of the Bible you want to believe, which is true. So if you can't believe Genesis, you can't believe any of the Bible. What should I tell him? And then related question, if you take evolution as being the way that God chose to make the world, how do you read Genesis, specifically original sin? How can a world be created through the survival of the fittest and then become perfect and then fallen again?
The first one about the dinosaurs, I don't understand because there's nothing in Genesis that would say, well, dinosaurs didn't exist. And there are parts of the Bible, like the book of Job, which might be a suggestion that actually specifically was there. I don't really see any problem with that. The second one is a much, much bigger problem. I think the question itself, I would have to rephrase it, though, because evolution is not a theory that tells us how the world came into being. Evolution is a biological theory of how life developed. Doesn't tell us how the world came into being, and it doesn't tell us how life began. It can't. It doesn't tell us about consciousness. All that evolution does is tell us how life there evolved. And there was already life to be evolved. There were the principles. There was everything set in place for that. Now, there are three different Christian positions. I have people in my own congregation and in my own eldership who would hold actually to all three. One is young earth creationism, the belief that the world is relatively young, maybe 30,000 years, 10,000 years or whatever. There's old earth creationism, the belief that the world is billions of years old, but that Adam and Eve were specially created. And then there's theistic evolution, which believes that the world is billions of years old, that Adam and Eve evolved through a process of a common ancestor, and that at some point God breathed his spirit into them or into a group of human beings, and they were made in the image of God. I think there are problems actually with all three positions, and I don't know the answer to them, and I'm not all that bothered, because to me, Genesis teaches that God made the world, that there was a beginning, that human beings were made special, that there was a fall, and there is a promise of redemption. I'm not sure that I find it easy to go much beyond that. So, original sin, that's an interesting one, because the idea in that is that the world was made perfect. Now, was it made without death? That's an interesting question. Did plants die? Did the animals eat plants before there was sin? Well, I think they did. Did animals die? Personally, I think they probably did. Did humans die? Well, I believe in special creation. I believe there was a literal Adam and Eve, and I believe that they did not die. But it's interesting when people take it literally. Adam and Eve are told, the day you eat of it, you will die. Well, that day they didn't die, at least not physically. I think the principle of death was embedded within them, and I think that the whole earth, if you like, changed, that there was a cancer crept in through sin. I think that spiritually, certainly, they died instantly, that they lost that relationship with God. So it's not quite as simple as either of these questions suggest, but I personally don't see any problem. If someone came to me tomorrow and said, David, here, I can prove to you macroevolution. Now, no one's been able to do that, but if they did, I'm not going to turn around and say, okay, I'll give up my Christian faith. I might have to reinterpret some things that I'd thought. If someone came to me and gave me the bones of Jesus Christ, then I would give up my Christian faith. So I just don't think it's that key a question.
Okay. Can I give an opportunity for any of you guys to come back on that? We probably won't get into big debates between Christians about the different views on the way that the world came into being. But if any of our guests or anyone else wants to pick David up on anything that he said, I'd be delighted to take a question from the floor. Terribly intimidating to be the first one to do that, though.
But that's okay.
You look entirely unimpressed with the idea. Let me push on then with the second question. David, you're going to have to explain the question as well, okay, as the answer. John Lennox suggests that the anthropic principle can be seen to point to God. How do atheistic scientists explain this?
Yeah. Okay. The anthropic principle is the view that... how do we explain how we're here? How have we got this universe that we've got at the moment? And basically, the problem there is the universe is so finely tuned, it's very implausible that it could actually exist without it having been someone having done the tuning. Now, the anthropic principle says, look, no, we don't start with that. We start with the fact that we are actually here, and it's just the way it is. I think that's very unscientific. Lennox, his argument is, actually, if you do look at human beings, and you look at the world that it is, and you look at the universe, then it's strong evidence of a creator. And he uses a great illustration. Let's see if I'm sure I've always carried it with me. Yeah, this thing. Many of you will have one of these phones or whatever. If I put it onto music and press random, you are, who knows what's going to come up? Well, I do. It could be Beethoven. It could be Led Zeppelin. It could be Mumford & Sons. It could be Sam singing. You know, it could even be a sermon by Paul Clark, because I do actually have one on here. It just random.
Rare taste.
Yeah. You'd be really unlucky if you ended up with that one. I'm driving along my bike, got headphones, and I can't. And it's just on random select, and Paul Clark's sermon comes up instead of Led Zeppelin. I'm going, oh no, I got to cycle to the church really quick. It's an incentive. Well, is it random? No, because here's a basic axiom of science. We know now that everything consists of information. I mean, this is an extraordinary discovery. We know that everything, the pews that you're sitting on, they're made of information. Every in your body, your human genome can stretch all the way to the moon and back. It's the code, the sequencing. It's information. It's all information. But what we know about when this, the reason that that music is in there is because I put it in there, or my daughter put it in there. Someone put it in there. That's it. It's there. Someone created the music and someone put it in. And it's the same with the whole information idea. Linux, I love this. I had a private conversation with him one time, and he said, David, what does it say in John 1:1? What does it say in Genesis 1? In the beginning, God created. What did he do? He spoke, and it came into being. He spoke. God said. God said. God said. He imparted information. Now, another axiom of science is simply this. Information doesn't self-generate out of nothing. Information comes from somewhere. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Colossians, Christ created all things. I actually think the current discoveries of modern science and the language of the Bible actually fit together very, very well. So the anthropic principle is that we're here, that we think, that we feel, that we love, that we have this huge amount of information within us, that we can reason and so on, and all of that points to us being created by someone greater than us. Because you end up with two options. You either end up that your mind is a product of mindless matter, or your mind is a product of a greater mind than you. And to me, the most logical one is clearly that my mind is a product of something greater than myself.
David, two quick questions here. Do you think that humans will one day know all the answers? That's a simple yes or no.
Yeah, no.
No? Okay, no. Thank you. If enough people believe a fact, does it become true? And then I've got one more question for you.
Yeah. If enough people believe a fact, no, again, that question means if it's a fact, it's a fact whether people believe it or not. If everyone here believed that St. Andrews was the greatest place in Scotland, it wouldn't make it true. Because we all know it's a fact that Dundee is. there are things that are facts. Supposing you believe that the world is flat, would that make it a fact? No, it wouldn't. It would just mean that an awful lot of people were wrong. Facts are facts. In Scottish, for those of you who don't speak Scots, facts are cheels that win a ding.
Say that again, just a bit more slowly.
I'm going to educate you. Facts are cheels that win a ding. Facts are things that, you can't go, they're facts. They're just there. And whether you or I think they're facts or not, they are facts. And the great question of science is, how do we discover what facts are? Not do we make things up, not do enough people believe it, but how do we discover what's true? I believe there is such a thing as a fact. I believe there is such a thing as truth. And I believe that all my life I will be looking for and discovering. Let me just explain it this way. When I first became a Christian, I thought I was like the kid in charge of the paddling pool. You know, sometimes you play that game, I'm the king of the castle and you're the dirty rascal. You know, this was, I thought I knew everything. I knew all the answers to it. I mean, I lectured my teachers on how the world was going to end and everything. I was just so embarrassingly arrogant. And now I'm completely humble. Now I realize that what I'm doing is I'm standing at the edge of the ocean, dipping my toe in, and there's so much more to learn. Do you know, I actually think we'll spend all eternity learning? Which is like a really weird concept. I can't even get my head around eternity, but I'm certain that it's there. So I'll leave it with that.
Thank you. Here's my final question then. You just touched on it. I know you've just written a whole book on this, so this is maybe a slightly unfair question. But you said that you tried to be an atheist for a little while. You've said that you now come to believe in Jesus. And you've made some pretty big claims about Jesus. The passage you referred to, it talks of him as the maker of everything, of him rising from the dead and stuff. Just without inviting you to give a whole another sermon, why is it that you are willing to stake your life and your eternity and your family and everything on this idea that Jesus is the Lord of everything?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is, I do a lot of what's called apologetics, where you go and argue about different things and so on. And I find an awful lot of it is arguing about theism. It's just like saying, can you believe in God and so on. I just keep coming back to this, that my ultimate reason for believing is Jesus Christ. And the reasons I would give for that, well, I wrote a book called Magnificent Obsession, so I'm not going to go through it all. But as a historian, the character of Jesus Christ, the person of Jesus Christ, I examined his claims, There's an element of personal experience as well, which I can't ask you to believe because of my experience, but I'm just saying simply that it's there. What I would say is, to me, the Christian worldview fits and makes sense, and I've never found anything else that fits and makes sense. So Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I probably spent most of my life examining that claim, and increasingly, more and more, I am convinced that that is absolutely true. I don't like religion very much. I follow and believe and trust in Jesus Christ. And the bottom line is, I don't think I've got anything else or anyone else. I choose not to believe that we live meaningless existence in a meaningless universe. And so Christ, for me, provides the meaning. And I think that, I honestly think that if you look and you examine, if you seek, you will find. And I guess that's the purpose of all that we are doing. There's a marvelous modern hymn that we sing, In Christ Alone, My Hope Is Found. Mr. Cox, his hope is found in that human beings are really cool, and that human beings are good, and that we're going to save the planet, and that we'll live for another 100,000 years before it all collapses. That's not much hope. I'll leave you with a sweet story. I did a debate down in London on the subject, actually, of same-sex marriage, which we wandered off all different directions. And I really liked the guy I was debating with. He was a liberal party gay activist, and he was there with his partner, and he and I, I really enjoyed talking to him. We had a really, really good discussion. Anyway, at one point, the church was filled with LGBT activists and West Indian Pentecostals, it seemed to me. That was the two groups. And at one point, one of the West Indian Pentecostals stood up and said, and I'll not do the Calypso accent thing, but he stood up and he said, gentlemen, I'd like to ask you, what is your only hope? And my opponent stood up and he said, well, as a liberal Democrat, my hope in life is that we'll reduce tax to £10,000 for people. And I started laughing. And I said, I'm so sorry. I said, but that does make me laugh. I said, I have to say to you, get a life. That's your hope? You really? Seriously? I said, gay marriage would come before that if I were you, you know, if I believed what you believed. But I said, that's really your hope? I said, I'm sorry. I don't wish to speak in cliches, but my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. And all the West Indian Pentecostals, hallelujah! So I won the debate. But that's where I come in. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. And if that's meaningless religious cliche to you, ask us when we're having tea and coffee and find out. Because there is no more important question than this. What do you think of Jesus Christ?
David, thank you. We often say if there's even a 1% chance that these things are true, then they merit our most serious examination and the desire to share it with our friends as well. I'm going to end our time before we get through for coffee by just reading that verse with which we began. Worthy are you, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created. Amen. Our subject next week is in this series is Jesus the only way to God? Is that the correct title? I think so. So that the same time next week in here. And then just as you come through for tea or coffee afterwards, if you're wanting to think about these things some more, the very best thing you can do probably is to read through one of the accounts of Jesus' life. We've got a whole pile of John's Gospels, and if you're a guest here tonight, we'd love to give you one to take away and read for yourself in your own time. And if your friend is in the church here, they're probably studying John's Gospel with us this year, and so they would be able to answer any questions that you had about any of it at any point. So they'd love to meet up with you over coffee and talk about it, I'm sure. Thank you very much indeed for coming. David, did you want to just plug your...
Oh, yes, sorry, I keep forgetting these things. Solas, we have a day on the 22nd